Welcome to the Motley Fool Radio Show. I'm David Gardner, broadcasting from Fool Global Headquarters here in Alexandria, Virginia. Here each week, through the hot weeks and the cool ones, to talk about the motley world of money and investing. On this week's show, we're going to talk about that enduring brand called, yes, The Dukes of Hazzard. It's a TV show turned movie now, and it's become a big business for Ben Jones, who was Cooter from the original cast. And I know I'd personally like to figure out, what is it exactly behind The Dukes of Hazzard that has made it so successful for such a long period of time? We're going to take your phone calls, of course, as always, later in the show, and we're going to play our game this week. It's Know Thy News. But we kick things off this week by talking stocks. We are investors on the show. We love to talk to successful fund managers out there, get their take on what's happening in business, get some of their investment ideas. John Buckingham is the president of Al Frank Asset Management, and the fund he manages, the Al Frank Fund, has an annualized return of around 14% over the last 5 years. That's drubbing the S&P average, which has been about flat over that time. John Buckingham joins us from the Al Frank offices in Laguna Beach, California. John Buckingham, welcome back to the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Thank you for having me.
John, let's begin by talking about Martha Stewart, who got 3 extra weeks of house arrest this week because, according to reports, she did some unauthorized yoga and four-wheeling. Your thoughts on the latest Martha Stewart news?
Boy, well, you know, it seems like she should have kept her nose clean a little while longer and got this all behind her, but it keeps her in the headlines, that's for sure. So maybe it was an orchestrated stunt, given that she has those two TV shows coming out.
As investors, we know that Martha is also involved with the public company that bears her name. John, is that a stock that you've ever looked at and or owned? Do you have any opinion about Martha Stewart Living today?
Well, we do follow the company, believe it or not, and obviously if you had bought it in the single digits and sold it when the day Martha got out of jail when it was above 30, you would have been very happy. But we could never justify buying it based on valuation. You know, the company at present is losing money, and if you look at fundamental metrics right now, even after having appreciated significantly from its lows, it's trading at about 8 times book value, 7 times sales, and it's just not a company I'd be wanting to invest in today.
And how about defining book value for us?
Well, book value is simply stockholders' equity per share. It's an indication of the value of the assets that a company holds, less all of its liabilities. And so we try to focus, especially in technology, on strong balance sheets. If you have a company that has lots of cash and no debt on its balance sheet, it's got more flexibility to make acquisitions, to invest in R&D, and to be able to survive if they happen to be in an industry that's going through a downturn. If you go back to the bubble bursting, the Global Crossings of the world didn't make it because they had too much debt. Amazon.com almost didn't make it because they didn't raise enough equity. And you can look at something like eToys, which obviously didn't make it, is now kaput. Mm-hmm. But eToys didn't raise enough in their IPO or didn't do any secondary offerings to raise enough money to survive the lean years. Had they done that, maybe they'd still be around today. So we want to buy companies that have solid financial strength, and often that is in registered by a solid book value.
John, do you call yourself a value investor?
Well, we're eclectic in what we do. We certainly focus on financial fundamentals, which makes us a value-oriented shop. But we do invest in technology, and as Warren Buffett has said, he doesn't understand tech, and most people who are value managers don't usually buy tech. But we've seen substantial value in that space over the years.
If you had to define what the phrase value investor is and then contrast it with another form of investor that is not a pejorative contrast, what would that be?
Well, basically a value investor tries to buy low and sell high, as opposed to many, I hate to call them greater fool because that sounds like Motley Fool, but greater fool investors who like to buy high and hope to sell higher. You know, there's nothing more bullish than a stock that's gone up for many investors. For me, there's nothing more intriguing than a stock that's gone down significantly. We just featured a company in our newsletter a month or so ago called Ditec Communications, which everybody loved at 25 but hated at 6. And we think you should be much more interested at 6, especially because they had a great balance sheet loaded with cash, and happily the stock's gone from 6 to 8 here in the last couple of months.
John, our producer informs me you're fond of a company called Microsoft. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, hopefully some of the listeners have heard of this little tiny software outfit out of the Washington state. But Microsoft has gone from being the quintessential growth stock to almost a poster child for value investors. Now, you know, clearly it's not at a level yet where some would say it's, you know, a single-digit P.E. ratio and it's a screaming, screaming value-oriented company. But Microsoft today is trading at about 21 times earnings, which is a little above the market average. And if you look on a going-forward basis, it's trading at about 19 times projected earnings, which is not exactly expensive relative to where Microsoft has historically traded, which is about 40 times earnings. So I think earnings growth is going to be strong over the next 5 to 10 years, and I'm able to buy a company that it's at a substantial discount to where it had been trading, and I'm getting a dividend yield of over 1%, plus we can't forget about that special dividend they paid out last year, which was $3 a share. Here again, you have a great balance sheet, no debt and lots of cash. Microsoft, of course, is loaded with cash, and we think that gives them the flexibility to raise their dividend, to buy back stock, to make acquisitions, and again, to come out with new and exciting products. So Microsoft, to me, is a value stock, and we've been buying it here lately.
I want to ask you about a few stocks on our minds here on this show, companies we've talked about before, companies that are out there being discussed a lot today, and I think I have to start with Google. I'm going to predict, John, that you do not own shares of Google.
Well, that's a pretty good assessment. Google is not a value stock, in my opinion, although certainly some are making a case that it is relatively undervalued if you contrast it with a Yahoo, or you apply some of Yahoo's metrics to where Google's earnings might be next year or the year after that. But I will say that Google is not ridiculously priced, as we saw in the bubble, where stocks were trading at, you know, price-to-sales ratios of 100, much less than not even making any money. At least Google's a profitable company. Now, it happens to be trading at 72 times earnings and 18 times sales. And that's too rich for our blood. And we'd be a buyer of Google if it were to drop to 150 or 160. And we actually had a few managed account clients come to us, and a couple of them own Google, and we sold it here recently at about 285. So I'm not a buyer of Google unless it gets down into the 150, 160 range. But it is not a poster child for the bubble, as we had many poster childs back in, you know, 1999 and 2000.
How about Netflix? That's a stock that I own.
Well, I'm hoping that someone can tell me how the business model makes sense in the long term. By that I mean, you know, you're sending things through the mail and you know, paying the postage both ways. I understand there's a subscription model and you make your money off your subscribers. But the thought process I have is that eventually the movie studios go direct to the consumer and zap this over the ether. I know there would be encryption issues and copyright issues and all that, but you know, what's to stop the content provider, if you will, from reaching the actual customer and skipping Netflix? That's my number one concern.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is, what's to stop Blockbuster, Walmart, and all the other guys from doing the same thing? And, you know, I said the same thing about Amazon, and I was proven wrong in the long run about Amazon, but I just am not wild about Netflix, especially based on valuation as well. It's not a cheap stock after having doubled here from the lows.
That is true. Netflix got really knocked down over the past 12 months, but in the past few months, it has just about doubled. I think part of the reason is that Walmart ended up exiting the business, in effect, and partnering with Netflix, and Blockbuster doesn't look like a formidable competitor. So it looks as if Netflix has cleared out its cash flow and growth in the near term, but you absolutely are right. The big question about Netflix is, what does it look like 5 or 6 years from now?
Right, and you know, in the defense of the Netflixians, the stock has actually appreciated, primarily, from my opinion anyways, because the earnings were so good. And so surprisingly, they actually made money when they were expecting to lose money. And if you look at analyst forecasts, they went from, you know, estimates of nothing or losses in 06
right,
to now where you're sitting here with the projected earnings of 73 cents. And a 73-cent earnings on a $20 stock is not ridiculously priced for a company that arguably has great growth potential. Of course, when I say arguably, I'm talking about the other people on the side of the argument,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to me, who suggests that I just can't see the long-term viability of the business.
Mm-hmm. There's a pretty good tradition of great investors enjoying telling a story or two about the times they've been wrong. You've had a tremendous record of success, John, and you've mentioned a bunch of very successful investments. How about one that got away and what you learned from it?
Well, we've been wrong 30% of the time. So what I've learned is that I can't put too many eggs in one basket. I remember I was selected for a Wall Street Journal contest. There was the dartboard contest. I don't
right.
know if you remember that, but mm-hmm. they'd have three professionals versus somebody throwing a dart, and you'd each pick one stock. And our PR firm said, "Don't do it because you know your one stock may go down, and you look like an idiot." Well, I chose to do it anyways, and the one stock I picked was an insurance company called Trenwick. And Trenwick at the time was trading about $7 or $8 a share. And when the contest ended, the stock was trading at about $3 a share, and today the stock's trading at zero per share because it's out of business. So what did I learn from that? Well, I learned that we can never pick them all successfully. The same valuation metrics we used to buy a Trenwick, we used to buy an Allstate, and Allstate has appreciated a couple 100% for us over the same time span. So the idea is you have to diversify. You can't be too full of yourself to say that my number one pick is going to be the stock that goes to the moon. And really just to pay attention to what has worked historically for us and not get too upset about the losers.
You can read more on John Buckingham at alfrankfund.com. John, thanks for joining us on the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Thank you for having me.
You gotta keep on keeping on if you want to win the battle. Sure that a winner never wins. You gotta keep on keeping.